right? The more of these stress factors that we start stacking on these animals, the higher risk they become. So we receive these animals, and that's when we can apply prevention and control strategies during that time, you know, at the initial processing event. Okay, and then once we move out from that and start to begin the early receiving period, that's when we start pulling and treating animals, and then that's when we apply therapy. All right, so just kind of a graphical depiction and trying to differentiate between the three places we can intervene with respiratory disease. Any questions, if any clarifications? I go through this. I mean, this is a large group, and I apologize. It's such a deep room, or else I'd have made my slides a little larger. So if you need some clarification back there, please raise your hand, and I'll do what I can. Okay, prevention specifically. And the best place to intervene here is back at the ranch, okay, what Dr. Rogers just talked about. Anything that we can do at the ranch of origin to better prepare these animals for the next phase in the industry is a good thing. Okay, even if we do minimal, it's still better than nothing. Unfortunately, a lot of animals that we receive as part of the feeding industry, a lot of these animals have had virtually nothing, okay, and been exposed to a lot of these stress factors. Things like vaccination and deworming, that's really what we're trying to accomplish when we talk about prevention, at least when we get our hands on these animals. We're trying to enhance the overall immunity level of the group. If we increase the number of protected individuals or number of immune individuals within a group, we've actually decreased the risk of that group of animals getting sick. Okay, that's really what we're trying to accomplish. Now, some groups, obviously, you know, each group is going to be different, and we're going to have better luck with that than with other groups. But that's what the goal is. And again, I mentioned this. This is the highest return on investment right here, if we can intervene with prevention. Okay, keep these animals from actually getting sick. There's a couple of classifications of the immune system. I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but just kind of make sure we're all on the same page. There's what we call innate or natural immunity. All right, that's kind of the body's own self-defense mechanism. Skin would be an example. Any sort of a barrier to infection. Okay, the skin provides a barrier to infection, to the pathogens that may be that these animals are exposed to or that we're exposed to on a daily basis. Things like mucus, the mucociliary escalator. Throughout the day, you're always clearing your throat. You're clearing. There's lots of mucus produced along your respiratory tract that helps to trap some of these pathogens that we're exposed to on a daily basis. Well, same thing in cattle. And when we expose these animals to things like transportation, throw these animals on a truck for 18, 20, 24 hours, we dehydrate these animals, and we have an impact on the mucociliary escalator. I liken it to if you fall asleep and sleep with your mouth open at night, you wake up and your mouth's pretty dry and throat's dry and coughing and hacking the next day for several hours until you kind of rehydrate yourself. Same thing happens here, and it makes these animals much more susceptible to some of these pathogens that they're exposed to getting down to the lower respiratory tract or the lungs where they can cause problems. It's heavily influenced by management. Okay, there's nothing that we can give these animals beyond management and husbandry. There's no magic vaccine or shot that we can give these animals to actually impact innate immunity. It's all a result of management. The adaptive or acquired immune classification is actually what we're trying to accomplish when we give these animals vaccines. We're trying to train the immune system. The immune system develops as or responds as a result of what we're giving them, either as a result of a vaccine or actually as a result of natural exposure as well. It's kind of a learned part of the immune system. Whenever I talk about immunity, I always like to point out that with any given group, there's going to be limitations on the number of animals that are actually going to respond. Okay? So what do we do when we vaccinate an animal? The only thing that we've really ensured is we've stuck a needle in them or stuck something up their nose and exposed these animals to the vaccine, right? What's the next step? The animal actually has to respond to that vaccine. I'm going to ask a question here, and it's kind of maybe become an arbitrary question, but in a typical high-risk set of calves, and that's kind of a there is no such thing as a typical high-risk set of calves, okay? But in general terms, what percentage of those animals do you think, when they come off the truck and you allow them to get a drink of water and maybe grab a bite of hay or feed, when you run through the chute and process them, what percentage of those animals do you think are capable of responding to a vaccine? 50%? 60%? 70? Less than 50? Any takers? I don't know. Okay, but it's less than if we walk a set of mature cows out of the pasture, walk them through the chute, and vaccinate them pre-breed. Okay? It's going to be significantly less, I think. I think the data would support that. So inherently, we've got a pretty potentially a significant number of animals that won't even respond to a vaccine. Okay? So we're behind the eight ball in terms of prevention already. And then let's say we've got some of those animals actually respond to the vaccine. The level to which they respond and are actually protected is going to be highly variable as well. Okay? If we've got a level of protection at here, and we have exposure at here, these animals are still at risk, okay? Still at risk of getting sick. Still at risk of breaking down whatever prevention strategies we may be trying to employ. Okay, let's talk a little bit about control. Okay, as I mentioned, control is applying an antibiotic to the group. And generally speaking, we're talking about an injectable antibiotic. Now, I realize there's things that you can put in the feed or antibiotics that you can put in the feed. We're going to kind of limit our discussion to the injectable products that are available. And if you look at the label, there's about six products that are approved for what we call the control and treatment of respiratory disease, bovine respiratory disease. Control, as I said, mentioned, refers to applying antibiotic for the control of bovine respiratory disease and cattle at high risk of developing respiratory disease. You look at the label and that's what it will say. Associated with, and it will list the pathogens, and that will vary depending upon the product that you're using. But the FDA doesn't like the term, or doesn't care for the terms metaphylaxis or mass treatment. They kind of have a negative connotation, if you will. So the FDA recognizes control. So if you look at that bottle of antibiotic, it'll say for the control of respiratory disease, and that's what we're referring to. What we call metaphylaxis or mass treatment. Okay, what's the primary reason you might select a control antibiotic? Okay, part of our group, I'm with Veterinary Operations, Pfizer Animal Health, and in our group we got a new tool to play with last summer. It's called an audience response system, and unfortunately we didn't have it available to use at this meeting, partially because of the size of the group. But what it allows you to do is I can hand out a remote to each of you, and I can ask you a question here on the screen, and you can have the opportunity to answer it. Some of you may utilize some of this technology. But this is one of the questions I like to ask, okay? You're applying an antibiotic to a set of calves that are coming in as part of a control. What are you really trying to accomplish? And I kind of hold you to select one answer. You might read through these and say, well, it's all of the above, okay? But I kind of pin you down to one answer. How many think the biggest benefit is reduction in number of pulls? Okay, got a few takers, all right? And there's a significant amount of data that supports that. Yeah, we do have a reduction in morbidity when we apply a control antibiotic to a set of high-risk calves. Okay, reduction in the number of deaths. Reduced number of dead cattle. Okay, a few takers, all right? And again, the list of studies that have been done to support that is pretty lengthy. I haven't bothered to reference them all. Improved performance during the receiving and feeding period. Any takers there? Okay, some more? Actually, that's fairly significant. One in the back there. Thanks for speaking up. Okay, how about operational efficiency? All right, excellent. A few takers on that. I think the second two is really where the opportunity lies. The bottom two, excuse me. Improving performance and improving operational efficiency. I'm going to kind of describe what I mean. I know what I was going to point out here. When I first started widely using a control antibiotic and some of the clients that started high-risk cattle, you know, one of the big selling points was it was going to reduce the number of pulls, reduce total morbidity, and it does. But you start thinking about that, when you apply an antibiotic to the whole group, you've already started out with 100% morbidity, haven't you? Okay? So how many fewer do you have to pull before you really pay for it just in reduction of sickness? So if you had a group that you thought you were going to probably anticipate pulling 60% of them, and you applied an antibiotic and treated them all, and then you only pulled 20%, is that really an advantage? So we're looking at 120% morbidity versus 60% morbidity, right? Have you ever followed that logic? So the real benefit of that has to come from the bottom two, right? Improving performance and reducing the number of deaths, improving operational efficiency. Okay, what is the dollar impact of respiratory disease? A lot of studies done look at this. I'm going to just kind of show the some of the most common, the Texas Ranch to Rail studies would obviously illustrate there's a significant advantage to animals not getting sick during the feeding period. Their studies over an eight-year period were about $87 or nearly $90 per head for those animals that did not get sick. Dr. Fulton at Oklahoma State has done some work that would demonstrate we treat an animal one time, costs us about $40. We treat an animal twice, we get up into that $60 range. We treat animals three or more times, they really get in our pocket. Why is that? Well, typically these ones that we treat multiple times are the ones that are going to die or wind up to chronics as chronics, and so those are the ones that really become expensive. Generally speaking, we treat an animal once and he responds and you know, returns to normal, supposedly, responds to initial therapy. Generally speaking, performance isn't as effective as those animals that don't respond to the initial therapy. The iceberg concept. This is why we really, truly apply a control antibiotic. Because there's only going to be a certain number of animals that we can actually detect illness in. Okay? And detection of illness, as you all know, is an imprecise science. Okay? It's an extremely difficult thing to do. In certain groups, it's more difficult to do than in others. Okay? But we can see some animals that we actually can assess are clinically affected. Those are the ones that are obviously sick. However, there's going to be a certain percentage, and depending upon the risk classification of the group, there may be some that are subclinically affected, okay, ones that are kind of smoldering, if you will. They're sick, but they may not be as easily recognizable as some of the others, right? And this is one of the real benefits with applying a control antibiotic to that group is we can impact those animals there, the ones that aren't clinically apparent. There have been a couple studies done to demonstrate this. Dr. Whittem in 1996 did a study where they followed cattle from when they were received into the feed yard all the way to slaughter. Okay, they tracked data, feeding data, and then followed these animals to slaughter and looked at lung lesions. Okay, as these animals were going through the harvest process, if you will. These cattle were handled as you would typically expect a set of feeder cattle to be handled once they arrived at the feed yard. For this group, they pulled 35% of those calves. Okay, through the entire feeding period. 35% of those animals got sick, were pulled and treated. At slaughter, they found lung lesions in 78% of the cattle. Right, they only treated 35%, they found lesions in 78% of the cattle. 72% of all the cattle had lung lesions. 78% of the 35% that were actually treated had lung lesions. Okay? 68% of untreated steers had lesions. So the bottom line is that, again, pulling sick cattle, recognizing sick cattle is an imprecise science. Probably the bottom line is we're treating cattle that don't need to be treated, and we're missing cattle that do need to be treated. Right? And one of the benefits of a control antibiotic is to help eliminate some of those animals that aren't clinically apparent to us in terms of when we go to pull and treat sick animals and apply therapy to them. In this particular study, the difference between those animals that had a lung lesion at slaughter and those that didn't was 46 pounds of gain throughout the feeding period. Okay, so pretty significant difference. Another similar study done by Dr. Gardner at Oklahoma State where they treated 50% of the group throughout the feeding period. 68% of all the steers had lesions. Okay, so there are 18% in there that they missed. 48% of the treated steers had lung lesions at slaughter. So they, of the ones that they treated, they guessed right on about half of them. Half of them had lung lesions, half of them didn't. Okay, so we're treating some animals that probably don't need to be treated. We're probably treating a lot of GI type issues as respiratory disease, applying an antibiotic to them, and they don't respond very well. 38% of the steers never pulled also had lung lesions. So again, the bottom line, we're missing cattle that need to be treated, and we're treating cattle that probably don't need to be treated. It's an imprecise science. Some of his conclusions were, cattle recovering from BRD never compensated for lost performance. And I think that's true, and I think we probably know that. The fact that 52% of the cattle treated for respiratory disease had no lung lesions. Again, this imprecise clinical diagnosis and imprecise clinical science. This strengthened the argument for mass medication at that time. Those are the terms they used. We now know it today as control. What about operational efficiency? You remember that fourth bullet point? Operational efficiency. And the best way I can sum this up, if respiratory disease or sickness in your feeder cattle operation is acting as a bottleneck, okay, if health in your operation is a bottleneck, then that's impacting your operational efficiency. If it prevents you from taking advantage of buying and marketing opportunities, maybe the market has presented you an opportunity to lay in a bunch of calves that you can lock in and make some money, okay? Laying in a set of profitable calves, but yet you're scared of health or scared of what health challenges will present, is that impacting your operational efficiency? Yeah, it is. If you're out there spending a lot of time treating sick cattle in any given group, and it's consuming a lot of time, is that pulling time away from other things in the operation that you could be doing, if not generating income, but helping to make you more profitable in other areas of operation? Yeah, absolutely, I think it is. And that's one of the real advantages, I think, to appropriately applying controlled antibiotics in certain situations. Beyond the cattle, one of the most common comments that we get anymore from folks that are utilizing appropriate control strategies are that, you know, my quality of life is much better. I think it's improved my outlook on my operation. I now have a weekend, okay? I now have some time to spend with my family. I spend less time treating and retreating sick cattle. I don't know. It's just it's really actually a quality of life issue. Some folks will say it's like, you know, this product, whichever one it is that I choose to use and use it effectively, it's like having another person. Okay, it's reduced the need for labor. And as we all know, labor in this segment of the industry has become pretty tight. One of our veterinarians, actually one of our customers who's a veterinarian in central Missouri, shared some of this information with me a couple years ago, and I'd like to kind of use it, and it kind of summarizes what we've just been talking about. But he compared an operation that was not using a control antibiotic previously, and then they started using a control antibiotic, and he took a snapshot of the operation prior to and after starting using a control antibiotic. And what these charts are representing is morbidity or pull rate prior to and after utilizing a control antibiotic. The top is prior to a control antibiotic. And you can see morbidity differences between the groups. Okay, you had a group occasionally that really fall apart in there, 30 to 40% morbidity. Then you'd have a group that, you know, did pretty well. Maybe you only pulled 10 to 15% of the group. But there was a huge variability between groups of cattle, which there is anyway. Okay, we all know that. There's going to be huge variability anyway. But it was really dramatic prior to using a control antibiotic. When they applied a control antibiotic, you can see the variability decreased a little bit. We still had some pretty substantial variability, which, you know, we're not going to avoid. But what in his mind, in this owner's mind, what it allowed them to do was apply some sort of consistency and predictability to any given set of cattle. We had fewer swings in terms of how health was going to impact us in those particular groups. There wasn't maybe, if you look at it on an average basis, maybe not what you would expect to be a huge difference in actual average morbidity between the two scenarios, but the difference was in consistency and predictability. The other thing that allowed these folks to do as a result of that was they moved from 1,500 to 2,200 head that they moved through their operation on an annual basis. No real improvement in terms of they didn't increase the number of either the land they had available or the number of pens that they had available to start cattle in, but they were able to move cattle more efficiently through their operation because they had less issues with health, and so they were actually able to move more animals through their operation and become more efficient as a whole. So in conclusion, treatment programs are great, and Dr. Applin is going to talk about that, and there are some actually things that we can do in terms of our treatment programs to evaluate or to apply to have a tremendous impact on our treatment success. They're critical parts of our operation, but we're, as I mentioned earlier, that's probably the most inefficient place to apply some sort of BRD intervention. Things that we can do prior to that in terms of procurement, you know, what types of cattle we're buying, whether it's preconditioned cattle or really high-risk cattle, you know, that may be a prevention strategy that you want to apply. Maybe there's certain times of the year or certain the market may be presenting you an opportunity to lay in cattle that are preconditioned that are going to have less health issues if that fits into your operation. But this is really where we can have an impact on efficiency and predictability. I'm always a big believer in consistent protocols. Okay, if I don't get anything else across to you today, I would encourage you to apply consistent protocols across your operation, whether it's feeding, your animal health selection, anything that you can do or apply to your operation. Consistency is key. It's very difficult to go in and evaluate what's going on in an operation when there's no consistency. One of the questions that I ask with our audience response system, what's the most consistent input into your operation? Feed, cattle, weather, animal health products. Our animal health products, I think, are an opportunity for us to improve our consistency. Okay? Improve the consistency we can apply at least to our protocols. And I need to throw in here the responsible and appropriate use, judicious use of antibiotics. You know, I've talked about applying a control antibiotic. There are certain groups of cattle that probably don't need a control antibiotic, and I think we all understand that. And obviously, the society we live in today is very sensitive toward the appropriate use of antibiotics. But I think in certain situations, in certain sets of calves, applying a control antibiotic is a judicious use of antibiotic in terms of reduction in animal suffering and improvement in animal performance. And then finally, measure and manage. Okay? If there's anything else you can do besides applying consistent protocols, measure what you're doing and manage it based upon the measurements that you're taking. I think those are tremendous steps that we can take, at least in this segment of the industry, to improve our results. So with that, that's all I had. Are there any questions real quickly? Must have put everybody to sleep. Or confused everybody. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it very much.
Our last speaker for this session is Dr. Mike Apple.